Keep thinking you need my notes. I've read your notes. I keep leaving you mine.
I'm going to muddle through. Non-alcoholic? I want to talk about bottom of page 84 on to page 85, which for me, when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would describe this as the fairy tale of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, when I came to AA and people said they didn't drink anymore, I believed you. But when you talk about not drinking and not missing it, I knew you were lying. I knew you'd do anything to drink and get away with it if you could. I mean, I just thought you were all hanging out here just holding on for dear life, because that's what not drinking feels like to me. You don't drink and you hold on for dear life. And I couldn't believe that people actually talked about the fact they no longer drank anymore and they didn't miss it. I didn't know what that was like. I had a lot of experience with quitting drinking, but no experience with quitting drinking and being comfortable. But by this part in our program of recovery, on the bottom of page 84, we get to hear about this fairy tale coming true. We have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity would have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us with any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And I'm so grateful for the fact that I'm a free man today, and I can go anywhere the free men go, do anything that free men do. And the freedom that I've been given is a direct result of my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, I didn't see it coming. That was never going to happen for me. I was never going to be a guy that was free from the drink. And sometimes, you know, I get so spoiled in my life, I forget that. I forget that central fact of my life, and sometimes it hits me. You know, I'll be driving along, and I'll just have that crystal clear thought. I'll go, man, I don't have to drink whiskey today. And that's a big deal for me, and I hope I never lose sight of that, the freedom just from the bottle that I've been given by Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm sober, I'm back in the game, and anything's possible. And so I guard my sobriety. I don't take it very lightly. And I love these promises, these 10-step promises to talk about that. But I want, you know, Sheldon talked on the 10th step, and he talked about this little short paragraph that has so much information in there. And the first thing you notice about it is you got the word continue in four different places. And if somebody had been through the steps and they'd had the psychic change and they came to me and they said, well, what the hell do I do now? I'd say, continue. For God's sakes, continue. Because most of the time when you find somebody who gets the gift in Alcoholics Anonymous, has had the merciless obsession removed, and they go back to the grinder, if you ask them what happened, usually they'll tell you a lot of different things, but it can be boiled down to this. They didn't continue. They usually talk about what they stopped doing that at one time they were doing. You know, I stopped working with others. I stopped working the steps. I stopped taking commitments. I stopped going to meetings. It's usually the lack of continuance that drives you out the doors in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're going to talk about continuing taking personal inventory. And as Sheldon say, it doesn't say if these things crop up, it says when they crop up. It's a promise I'm going to continue to be perfectly imperfect. So I want to tell you a couple of quick 10-step stories and that are important for me and to kind of illustrate how this thing looks. Like, how does a 10-step show up in my life? And there's a couple of ways, you know. There's 10 steps that are really spot check. They happen very quickly. They're very fast moving. There are other ones where I actually have to slow down far enough to do a 4 or 5 or 6 column inventory. How many columns we're doing this weekend, I don't know. But God, I was about, maybe about 11 years sober, and I lived in Southern California, and I was probably married 7 or 8 years at this point, and we bought a fixer. Our first house was a fixer, and if you've ever owned a fixer, you know it's like the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. You always got a project going, and the project on tap that weekend was I'd already put a new roof on the garage, I had done the exterior, and now I was going to sheet the inside of the garage with half-inch plywood. That way I'd have a nailable surface on the inside. And by this time, I'm becoming pretty proficient with my hands, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a beautiful Southern California Saturday, and the night before, I went to the supply house, and I bought all the plywood and threw it in my truck. And while I was at the supply house, you know, the hammer display caught my eye, man. So I went over to check out the new hammers. Boy, and they had this Vaughn 24-ounce framing hammer. It was a thing of beauty, and I grabbed it, and the balance of my hand felt good, and had a waffle end. It was so sharp you could cut your thumb with it, and I went, oh, I want this hammer. So I bought that hammer, and that night, man, I had a vision, man, of me just swinging that hammer and hanging that plywood the next day, and it was going to be great. And the first thing next morning, me and my wife, we coffeeed up, and I'm in that garage. We got the radio going, and I'm hanging that half-inch plywood, and she's in the corner, and we're having a great time, man. We're young. We're in love. We're grinning at each other. The music's going. It's perfect weather. She's planting her little plants, and I am swinging this hammer, and I'm sinking these eight-penny nails in this half-inch CDX plywood. Ba-ba-bam! Ba-ba-ba-bam! And I'm thinking to myself, damn, I'm pretty good. Ba-ba-bam! And I'm hanging this plywood. And at one point, I mishit this one nail, and I'm holding the piece of plywood up, and I mishit it, and that hammer goes, ba-ba-bam, and it hits this thumb dead square, man, and a rooster tail of blood just squirts all over the plywood. And I did exactly what I do when I opened up my thumb with a 24-ounce framing hammer. I just cursed a blue streak as loud as I could. I made up words of profanity. I don't know if they're real words or not. Screamed them as loud as I could. I moved in a 360-degree circle, kicking everything in my radius as hard as I possibly could as I cursed. And then I finished, grabbed some duct tape, wrapped it up, went back to work. And now I notice there's a change in the environment in the garage. A cold front has moved in. And I look over at my wife, and she's got that look on her face. I've seen it before, like she just ate a lemon, you know. I'm looking at her, and I said something spiritual to her, like, what? And she goes, mm-mm. And I go, what? What's going on? Something's obviously bothering you. And she goes, you know what? I don't want to talk about it. I said, well, why don't you tell me what's bothering you? She goes, you know, I've talked to you about it before. I don't want to get into it. You know, you don't believe me. Listen. You're 6'5", you're 280 pounds. When you scream and yell and kick things, I know you don't, it's not directed at me, but it scares the hell out of me. You terrify me. But I've talked to you about it before, and I know it's going to happen again, so let's just leave it alone. And I looked at her, and I said, you got to be kidding. And I just dropped my hammer on the ground. I said, you know what? You're insane. You expect too much from me. I don't know what you expect me to be. I'm a man, damn it. You know what? You want a butler. You want somebody that does everything you want to do when you want them to do it. You ask too much of me. You're unreasonable is what you are. You know what? Go to the meeting tonight. Pick 10 guys at random. I don't care who they are. And ask them what happens when they split their thumb open with a 24-ounce framing hammer. If they're a real man, they'll tell you. They curse, they kick, they scream, they yell things, and then they wrap it up and they go back to work. You're ridiculous. And I storm out of the garage. Now I'm in my office arguing with my wife, who's still out in the garage. She's not even there. And I'm pacing back and forth like an idiot. I don't know how I ended up with you. Why did I marry you? Why did I think this was a good idea? And in the back of my mind, I hear my sponsor's voice go, this is probably a good time for a 10th step. And I know at this point I can't do a 10th step. I'm too upset. I'm cut off. I'm cut off from the process. I'm cut off from God. I'm just too angry. And I know I got to calm down. So I finally sit down. I do some deep breathing. I get my heart under control, my heart rate under control, I get my breathing under control, and I start thinking about, okay, what's going on? What's going on with me? And I start thinking about the four column inventory. Okay, all right. I got a resentment. That's what's going on. I'm resentful. Who am I resentful at? I'm resentful at my wife. What's the cause? She's crazy. She's unreasonable. She expects too much out of me. She doesn't want me to be a man. She's always pointing out my spiritual deficiency. There's just no room for error with this woman, you know? Always. What does it affect? Well, it affects my confidence. It affects my self-esteem. It affects my security. I'm fairly certain it's going to affect my sex life. Setting aside the wrongdoings of others, I resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? What did she say? She said I terrified her. Has she said that to me before? She said I terrified her, and she's told me that before. Has she said that before? Yeah, she said that to me. In fact, she said that to me several times. Huh. Well, if she said it to you several times, why don't you believe her? Do you think your wife's a liar? Oh, no. Oh, no. I think my wife's one of the most honest people I've ever met in my life. Well, if your wife tells you several times that you terrify her, she's come to you with her truth, and you don't believe her, isn't that a subtle form of calling her a liar? Yeah, I can see that. So what do you think you're going to have to do about a thing like that? We're going to have to make amends. Our 10th step says we make amends promptly if we've injured anybody. So now I got to go back out there with my tail between my legs, and I got to make amends. So I go out, and I find my wife. I go, you got a minute I need to talk to you. She goes, I don't want to talk to you. And I said, I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all, but really, I need to talk to you. She goes, I don't want to talk to you. No means no. Take no for an answer. I go, baby, I just want to make amends. You got 5 minutes. So we sit down and I go, honey, you know what? You have talked to me about this before. You've been talking to me about this for years. And I got to tell you, I didn't believe you. I thought you're being overdramatic. I thought you're reacting. You know, I thought you're just being silly, to be honest with you. And the truth is, you know, that's a form of calling you a liar. And I don't think you're a liar, baby. And you know what? The last thing I want to do is terrify you. And I believe I've been scaring you. You know, baby, I want you to feel safe with me. Of all the places on the planet you can be, I want you to feel the safest when you're at arm's length from me. The idea that I'm scaring you just bothers the crap out of me. And I got to tell you, I feel so bad, and I'm so sorry, and I don't know what I can do to make it right, but I promise you this. I promise I heard you, and I believe you. Now, I can't promise you I'll never do it again. I've been this way my whole life, but I promise you I'm going to try, and I'm going to make it a spiritual piece of business, and I'm going to work on this. And she said, that's all I've ever asked from you. And now the sun comes out, and everything's fine in the garage, and we got the music going again, and we go back to work. And a couple hours later, I got the inside of the garage heated off, and she's got a bunch of things done, and we're having a good time, and now I'm hanging these shelves in the garage, and I got the shelves up, and now I'm putting quarts of paint up in the shelves, and I'm stacking them up there, and I'm pushing up the quarts in the very top, and as I pushed up, I didn't realize I pushed this one piece off, and it was probably about 6 inches from the top of my foot by the time I realized it had fallen, and it was too late to pull my foot, and I'm wearing flip-flops, and this full quart of paint hits the small bones on top of my foot, and it goes, bam! And I said, oh! And I looked at my wife, and her eyes were about this big, and I said, you can't believe how bad this hurts. This is like pain you can taste. And she started laughing, and I started laughing. You know, and after, and God, I did not realize that when I, you know, because one of the things we do in inventory is we ask ourselves, if the situation was repeated, what, if anything, would you do differently? And I'd already made a commitment to act differently in the future. I just didn't think God would give me the chance 2 hours later, you know. And you see, I just didn't know I could do it any different. I didn't know there was another way to go. You know, I've had trouble in my marriage. I've had this confusion about the mystery of marriage and how do you figure out a woman and what do? And how do you get to there? How do you make it work? How do you know what they need from you? It's just so confusing and so mysterious to me. And I didn't realize that all the information, all the answers to all the questions, to all the great mysteries of a woman was sleeping peacefully next to me in the bed every night. And I was afraid to ask. You know, and my wife and I started on a journey probably 15, 16 years ago to have a different experience with marriage. You know, our first 7 years weren't too slick, and the last 14 have been completely different. Because we made a commitment to learn how to talk to each other, learn how to bring Alcoholics Anonymous into our marriage. And we started doing silly things, man. I remember I heard about this dumb exercise. Some guy in AA told me about it, and it sounded cool. So I went home to my wife and said, hey, you want to do this exercise? It sounds like fun. She goes, well, yeah, sure. What is it? I go, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, I want you to rate me. She had a number instantly. It was not the number I was thinking of. I had to control my face, you know what I mean? And act all cool. And I said, well, if I am a 6, maybe a 7. How would I get to be a 7, maybe an 8? She had an answer for that too. Didn't even have to think about it. It was kind of insulting. She said, well, you could look at me when I talk to you. My intellectual reaction to that was, what are you talking about? I look at you when you talk to me. But, you know, I'm trying to be spiritual, Don. I'm trying to take this stuff under advisement. I said, well, okay, baby, I'll try to make sure I do that. A couple days later, we're on the couch, and she's talking to me. And she's about 5 minutes into telling me about her dairy, and I swear to God, my head starts to fly up like this. I would have rather looked at the blazing sun with my naked eyes than continue to look at my wife when she was talking to me. It was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. I'm just sitting there. My eyes are starting to water. I'm just staring there. I mean, I should have grabbed my own head and held on. What are you doing? I'm trying to look at you when you talk, damn it. You know, I had no idea that I had trouble looking at my wife when she talked to me. And I thought, my God, if I'm this wrong about that, what else am I wrong about? And my wife is funny. And here's a spot check 10 step. This is how fast a 10 step can be. And another example in my marriage. About 3 years ago, I'm minding my own business. There's no conflict in our marriage. We're getting along fine. No big deal. We're having coffee together in the morning. And she says, listen, I don't want to start anything. I have a question for you. I said, sure, baby, what's up? She goes, do you ever intend on, I don't know, making our bed? We've been married 18 years at this point. And I said probably the dumbest thing a man could say in that situation in the history of dumb men. I said, I thought you liked making the bed. She said to me, nobody likes making the bed. And at that moment, I did a spot check inventory. I ran it through in like 3 seconds. And this is what I said to my wife. I said, would you like me to make the bed? And she said, that'd be very nice. And I got to tell you, for the last 3 years, if I'm at home and we get out of that bed, I make the bed every day. It's not a big deal. It was a small adjustment, but I had no idea that this was a problem for her. And how many other things have been a problem for her that I'm just not aware of, or she tried to tell me, and I just wore her out by ignoring her. So I want to have a better marriage, and to have a better marriage, I have to go into that. And this principle comes actually from the big book and the fifth step. And remember, we're continuing to take personal inventory. That's steps 4 and 5. And it's the principle I touched on earlier. We usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. So when I'm trying to ask myself, how am I doing in my marriage, and I'm not talking to my wife, that's a fool's errand. I will never know how I'm doing in my marriage without talking to my wife. If I think I know how I'm doing at work without talking to my employer, I'll never know how I'm doing at work without talking to my employer. And I'll tell you, about once a month, I sit in, I just go into my boss's office, we sit down, we have a cup of coffee, and I ask him, how am I doing? Is there anything you'd like me to be doing that I'm not doing now? Is there anything that'd make you happy? But you know what? We won't do that. You know why? We don't want to change. We don't want to know. And that's just fear. Fear tells me you don't want to look. Don't rock the boat. You might find out something you don't want. But every area of my life, I've got to be willing to go to the people that are involved in that area of my life, and I've got to do inventory. And to have accurate inventory, I'll need their participation. If I don't, what I'm doing is I'm looking at the areas of my life, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm doing. Solitary self-appraisal. I'm not talking to my sponsor. I'm not talking to the people involved. I'm grading myself. And I got to tell you, when I grade myself, I grade easy. That's my experience. I want to tell you another quick 10-step story, and then we'll stop by. I already talked a lot about my sister this weekend, and she's like my favorite person on the planet. Got sober in her house, spent my first 2 years of sobriety living there. When I moved out, she cried. I mean, we're just really good friends. And we've been friends my entire sobriety. But when I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years sober, she went through a tough patch in her life, and she got divorced. And it was tough on our family. It was tough on everybody, because we all loved Larry, and he's a great guy. He's a great guy to this day. And they were that couple we never thought would get divorced, ever. They always seemed so happy and got along so well, and it was tough, you know. And they were splitting up assets, and they were going to sell the house and move to different places. And my sister called me up. I was real concerned with her, and I was on the phone with her, like, every day. I mean, I was calling in and talking to her every single day for months, leading up to the finalization of this divorce, just checking on her, seeing how she's doing. And finally, they were selling the house, and the house closed in escrow, and they had to get all their stuff out of it. And she said, can you help me move? I said, absolutely, it'd be my pleasure. And I got a bunch of my AA buddies together, man. We showed up on a Saturday, and we did what we do in AA, man. We moved all of the furniture that she was getting out of the divorce, and we moved it across town and moved it into her new place, and we busted her ass all day long. And I was so proud of my friends in AA and so proud of Alcoholics Anonymous, the way these guys showed up for free and for fun just because there was a need, just because they had an affection for me. They said, of course, we'd love to help you. We understand. And they were kind to my sister, and they were such good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of the day, we're all done, and I'm getting ready to say goodbye to my sister and my brother-in-law, Larry, who I've been friends with Larry before they got married. And Larry showed up, and I was just catching up with him and talking, and it's uncomfortable. And he, you know, told me how much he hoped we could stay in touch and how much he loved me. And I was thanking him for everything he had done for me. And he said, listen, while you're here, he goes, I got one piece of furniture I'm keeping. That's it. That little armoire over there. And I've rented a place like 2 blocks down the street. Do you think you could move it for me? I said, Larry, I'd love to do that. And I picked up this little armoire, and I threw it in my pickup truck, drove 2 blocks, dropped it off in the garage at Larry's house, drove back to my sister's house, went in, gave my sister a big hug. She thanked me so much for all the help. I said, I'll talk to you tomorrow. And I took off, and I felt good. Felt good about Alcoholics Anonymous. Felt good about the Living Amends. Felt good about that period of reconstruction I was taking the lead in. I was glad I could be there for my sister when she's having a tough time. Well, next day, I called my sister like I had been doing every day, and I got her voicemail, which wasn't unusual, and called to tell her I loved her and just give me a call when you get a minute. And she didn't call me back. And that was unusual, but I didn't think much of it. And I called her the next day and left her a message, and she didn't call me back that day. A third day, I called her and left her a message. She didn't call me back. I started getting worried, and I called my mom. And I said, have you talked to Pat? She goes, God, I just talked to her 15 minutes ago. I go, she okay? She goes, she's fine. I go, it's the weirdest thing. I've left her 3 messages, and she hasn't called me back. My mom went, oh. And I went, what, oh? And she goes, did you happen to move a piece of furniture for Larry? And I said, yeah, I moved an armoire. It was like, I don't know, one, two blocks down the street after I had moved an entire house of furniture for her. She goes, well, that pissed your sister off. I go, you got to be kidding me. She goes, I don't know. She said, you're her brother, not his. That, you know, you shouldn't be doing stuff for the enemy. She went on this whole rant. And I said, you got to be kidding me. What are we, 8 years old? You got to be. And I said, that's ridiculous. And I get off the phone, right? I made the mistake is I'm driving somewhere and I call my sponsor and I'm telling him about my sister and all this. And he goes, well, sounds like you got a resentment. And I go, I don't have a resentment. I'm just pissed off. I don't have a resentment, all right? She's being ridiculous. You got to tell what part could I possibly have? How could I be wrong in this? And he goes, well, I don't know. Maybe she just, let's just go through this. My sponsor went through it with me on the phone. And so here's what we came up with. I'm resentful. Who am I resentful at? My sister. What's the cause? She's being unreasonable. I do all this stuff for her. It's very obvious I love her. I've always been in her corner. I move one lousy piece of furniture, and this is the way she is. What's it affecting? Well, it affects my security. It affects my self-esteem. It affects my confidence. It's hurting my feelings, you know? And okay, I'm going to put that out of my mind. He asked me a question. He said, how many years did you drag your sister through the mud? I don't know. Over a decade. When everybody in the entire planet quit on you, who was the one person that didn't quit on you? When you were at your lowest point, nobody wanted anything to do with you, who opened up their home and took you in? I said, my sister. I said, so a person that did all that for you is what? At the lowest point of their existence, they're going through a divorce. Do you have any idea what that must be like for her? I said, no, I really don't. Do you think maybe you can give her this one? Do you think maybe you can show her the same compassion and patience and love and pity that she showed you all those years? And now I feel about 2 inches tall. And I said, of course I can. And I felt terrible. And what ensued for me was a year where I called my sister once a week. And I called her once a week like we had just talked the day before. And I'd say, hey, Pat, it's Don. How you doing? Just checking in. Just wanted you to know I love you. Hope everything's going good in your world. I'd tell her a little story about Eileen. I'd tell her something about going on in work, something going on with AA. I'd say, hey, get around to it. Just give me a call back. Just want you to know I was thinking of you and I love you. And I'd leave that message and she wouldn't call back. And I'd call the next week and I'd say, hey, Pat, it's Don. Just checking in. Just been traveling a little bit. Eileen's doing great. Garden's coming in beautiful. You got to see the house. We've made a lot of changes. Love to see you. Have you over for dinner if you get time. Just know that you're loved and you're missed. And I'm thinking of you. Hey, if you get around to it, you give me a call. No call back. I did that for a year. I left her a message every week. So at the appointed time and that time of the week where I always called my sister, I called her this one week. She answered the phone. I didn't know what to say. I was just waiting for the answering machine. Suddenly she's like, hello. And I go, Pat? And she's like, yeah. And I go, how's it going? She's like, good. How are you? Like nothing had happened. And we made some small talk and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, maybe we should get together and have a meal. She goes, that's great. Let's get together and have lunch. It's the weirdest conversation in the world, like nothing had happened. And we went to lunch. And I had a commitment when I went there, and I made it with my sponsor. And I said, I'm not going to ask. He goes, don't. Just go and enjoy lunch. I go, that's what I'm going to do. And I did really well. I made it about 45 minutes, right? And after about 45 minutes, man, I've already paid the bill and the waiter's going, we're getting ready to go. And I'm sorry, Pat. You know, I said I wasn't going to do this, but I got to ask. And she goes, I know. I can't believe you made it this far. And I go, is it okay to ask? She goes, it's absolutely okay to ask. I go, what the hell was that about? And she goes, oh, she goes, listen, you don't understand this. I go, this has been a tough year for me. And she goes, you know, when Larry and I split, I didn't see it coming. I didn't know my marriage was going to end. And it broke me in ways I didn't know I could be broken. And I was really angry. And I was really hurt. And I think I needed somebody to be safe with. I needed to be really angry with somebody that wouldn't throw me away. And I knew I could be angry with you. And I knew I could treat you badly. And I knew you wouldn't throw me away. I knew you wouldn't quit on me. And I got to tell you, it got worse, not better. And I had to go under psychiatric care, and I had to go on medication because I was suicidal, and I didn't know if I could find a reason for living. And every day I had to find another reason for not killing myself. And I got to tell you, there were a lot of nights, Donald, I was curled up in the fetal position, and I couldn't stop crying, and I was trying to think of a reason not to kill myself. And I'd get my phone out, and I'd play every message you'd left me. And I had every message you ever left, and I'd play them over and over and over in a loop. And I'd sit there with tears in my eyes, and I'd hear how you said that you loved me, and I'd hear the joy in your voice, and you'd be making those funny voices, and you'd be telling me those funny stories. And I thought, not tonight, maybe tomorrow, but I won't kill myself tonight. And you got to understand that although I wasn't talking to you, you were with me every step of the way. And thanks for hanging in there with me. And I got to tell you, it's the greatest backhanded compliment I ever got, that I was making those amends to somebody, and I didn't even know I was doing it. I was taking sponsored direction. I was doing what I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what was going on with my sister. She cut off all contact with me, but I kept doing what my sponsor said. We kept making the approach. We kept making the approach. And I got to tell you, a couple of years ago, I had the honor and privilege of going to Iceland and carrying the message over in Iceland. And my wife, Eileen, and I, and a friend of mine were going to go over there. And my sister caught wind of it. She said, "Well, you're going to Iceland?" I go, "Yeah, we're going to go to a couple of AA conferences." She said, "Can I go?" And I go, "I don't think it's going to be a lot of fun for you, Pat. We're just going to be doing AA for a couple of weeks, going to a couple of conferences." She goes, "Oh, I'd love to go." My sister went to Iceland with us on her own dime so she could hang out and just go to AA meetings as an observer, just a friend of the alcoholic. Of course, she did a couple of times say, "When do I get to talk?" And I was like, "Never." And she was like, I'd get done talking and she'd whisper in my ear, "One of these days I'm going to tell them the truth." And we'd laugh and laugh. And I got to tell you, she loves Alcoholics Anonymous and she loves you. And you know, and this thing, this, I tell you this story because you don't know where this stuff goes. You don't know how you affect people. And I feel the same way that my friend Sheldon feels, you know. But I also want to mention this, I'm not that noble. You know, this had a lot to do with a sponsor who kept me grounded. Because I'm the guy, I get a resentment, I condemn you, and I move on with my life. You know, and I'm so glad I had a sponsor that was willing to take the time and continue to do inventory with me and point out these things to me that makes it possible for me to be a better man than I am naturally. Let's take a break. We're going to get started again. Don Alcoholic.
Hey, Don.
We're going to start talking about the 11th step here. On page 85, down at the bottom of the page, it says, "Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than us are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions." So I want to talk about what the 11th step looks like in my life. The first thing when we start talking about when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. I want to stop right there. Of all the exercises in Alcoholics Anonymous, as a member and as a sponsor, the most difficult suggested action in Alcoholics Anonymous with step work has been the evening review. The 11 step evening review gave me the most difficulty to get consistent with it in my sobriety. It's been the most difficult thing for me to get my guys consistent with it and continues to be quite daunting for a lot of the guys I sponsor. I want to just throw out a little helpful hint here, something that took me many, many years to start thinking about, and I changed the way that I approach my 11-step review. So the very first line says, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. This is what I thought that meant for me. It meant right before I go to bed. Now, it doesn't say right before I go to bed. What it says is when we retire at night. My translator that lives in my head, I will take things and I will translate them from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous into my own language, and I will interpret things and I won't talk to anybody about it, including my sponsor. So what I was trying to do with my nightly review was wait till right before I go to bed. You know that part where you can't even watch TV anymore, your eyes are fluttering, they're about to close, and your head's kind of nodding off, and you go, "Man, I'm really tired, I should probably go to bed." And I would turn off the TV and I'd think, "Damn, I got an 11-step review to do." And I get my big book out and I kind of read the questions and I go, "Well, I got up, I didn't kill anybody today, that's not bad for a guy like me, yay God," and I'd go to bed. And I'd kid myself, "I'll do better tomorrow." Years, and I'd love to tell you 4 or 5 years, more like 12 or 14 years into sobriety, I'm still inconsistent with my 11-step review. And I'm having a hell of a time doing it. And one day it struck me, because we got in the habit of looking up words in our book studies. And I started looking up the word, and I looked up the word retire. And one of the definitions for retire is work completed. And I thought, huh, well, let me think about that a little bit. And so what I started thinking about, when I retire at night, what have I said when my work was completed? When is my work completed? Now, on an average day, I'll give you a typical Monday. I go to work. I'm usually up by 6, 6:30 in the morning. I'm out the door by 6:45 or so, and I go and I work all day, and at the end of the day, I'll come home, and I'll say hi to my wife. I'll maybe grab a shower, and then I'm back out the door to my book study. And I go to the book study with the guys, and after that, we'll probably fellowship a little bit, and then I come home. Usually a couple of things I got to get done on the house, maybe a few chores, maybe take the dog out for a walk. But at that point, it's probably about 10 o'clock at night, and I am far from going to bed. And now we're entering into a phase of my day that I like to call quality Donnie time. Quality Donnie time is after I've done my AA stuff, I've gone to work, I've done all the honeydews, everything's done, and now I got a couple hours before I have to hit the rack and get ready for the next day. And what I used to do is I would just go right into relaxation, watching TV, watching a movie, do whatever I want, playing a video game. And what I started to do was I started to do my 11-step review at that point. And the funny thing about that is quality Donnie time, I'm wide awake. I just got in the house, I did a couple of things, I am wide awake. And suddenly the 11-step review at night became very easy. And I realized most of the problem I was having with it wasn't the work that I was being asked to do, it was the time I was trying to do it. And I found that I'm not very effective on doing anything right before I go to bed. Right before my head hits the pillow and I say goodnight to the world and I say goodnight to God, I'm not very effective to get anything done. Anybody that's ever known that, I mean, in our house, we have a rule. We try not to have any major discussions after 9 o'clock at night. We're too tired and it's not going to be productive. There's nothing worse than you're laying in bed and you're just about to fall asleep and you hear your wife's voice go, I've been thinking, and your eyes roll up in terror and like, I bet you have. We should probably talk about that tomorrow. So now that I'm doing my nightly review at the end of my work, when my work is done for the day, I've completed everything. There's no more work to be done. Now I can stop and I can review my day and I can ask myself the questions outlined on page 86. And when I'm done with that, and I've asked those questions, I do this in a constructive manner. I do it with a little piece of paper, and if there's any notes I want to think, something I missed, something I've kept to myself, an opportunity to be of service that I missed, maybe something I need to discuss with my sponsor, I'll just write myself a little note. Maybe it's a little something. Maybe it's a sin of omission. I see a lot of that. I'll tell you, this is how I know I've had a bad spiritual day. I'll be doing my 11-step review, and I'll think something like this. Well, I know there must have been other people around today, but I can't remember any of them. That's an indication I was probably in my head most of the time. But usually for me, it's the sins of omission. Maybe there was an opportunity to be a service that I missed. Maybe there was something I thought about doing and I didn't do it. Maybe something popped in my head to call somebody, but I forgot to call them just to check and see how they're doing about that thing. I'll write myself a little note. And what I'm doing with these little notes is I'm taking it into my meditation in the next day. And in the morning, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to consider the 24 hours ahead. And what I'm going to do right when I wake up, and this is, I'm going to be real honest about this. I've heard some people say some pretty right-wing, really amazing things from the podium. I'm not that guy. I hear guys say, notice it says upon awakening, not after you've had a cup of coffee, not after you've gone to the bathroom, not after you've walked the dog, upon awakening. Okay, I get up. I'm 58 years old. I head to the bathroom. You know, I remember this joke I heard once. The guy goes to the doctor and he's 70 years old and the doctor says, what are you here for? And he goes, every day, doc, every day, like clockwork. I go to the bathroom at 6 a.m., like clockwork, 6 a.m. He goes, well, that's great at your age. You're consistent. What's the problem? He goes, I don't get up till 7. So the very first thing I do is I go to the bathroom. I've trained myself that when my eyes open up, my first conscious thought in my head is, good morning, God. I just say, good morning, God. Then I go off to the bathroom, and I use the bathroom. Then I waddle downstairs, and I get myself a cup of coffee. Then I go sit in the sunroom, and I start sipping my coffee. And I start getting my book out, and I start doing things. And I'm not doing anything except sipping coffee. And somewhere about halfway through that cup of coffee, I'm awake. And when I find myself awake, I start to do the simple things that the book talks about. And what I like that Bill wrote down is the very first order of business is I'm going to get my head right. Because Bill's insinuating that I'm going to wake up with a head that's not in a proper position. And boy, that isn't that true with me. I'll tell you, I used to struggle with this because I thought I was doing something wrong. To this day, and it's pretty much every day of my life, and I'll be quite honest with you, I will not use the word depressed because I think that's an insult to people that suffer from true depression. I do not, and I don't take it lightly. But I wake up every day a little blue. Now, when I say I wake up a little blue, it means in comparison to how I'm going to feel shortly. And I don't know why. I just wake up, and it used to worry me. You know, I used to talk to people in AA about it early in sobriety. You know, I wake up a little off my game. I wake up a little blue. I go to bed in a good mood, but I wake up, and I'm a little sad. I don't know what that's about. And well-meaning AA people would make suggestions. They'd say things like, well, invite God into your sleep. So I tried that. That didn't work. Try to read spiritual literature right before bed. Try to do that. That didn't work. Be careful that you're not watching anything negative on TV right before you go to bed. Well, how can you do that? Everything I like is negative on TV, you know? I'm not giving that up, for God's sakes. You know, that's a stupid suggestion. And then finally, I made the mistake of talking to my sponsor about it. And he just immediately had an answer. He said, well, Don, when you're awake, what we're shooting for is a conscious contact with a power greater than ourself. When you're asleep, you're unconscious. You can't have a conscious contact. There's a higher power. There's got to be a lower power. When you're asleep, your lower power probably comes out to play and runs through the field and does all kinds of things. You have no control over that. What's important is what you do when you wake up. Don't worry about what's happening when you're asleep. Nothing you can do about that. But what do you do when you wake up? And he pointed to this part in the 11th step. Well, what I'm going to do, the very first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask God to direct my thinking. That's a prayer. Prayer is a form of asking God to do something for me I can't do for myself, or to give me something I don't have naturally without his favor. Ask God to direct my thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. How do I wake up in self-pity? God, I wish I was rich. I wish I, you know, had a family with money. I wish somebody would die and leave me a bunch of dough. I hate going to work. That's called self-pity. Dishonest. Boy, maybe I can show, you know, I'd like to really hope this day goes quick. You know, I got that appointment at 3 o'clock. I don't know why I'd make an appointment at 3 o'clock. I don't try to make them after 2 o'clock. Maybe I'll call up and I'll make up a story and I'll tell that guy that something came up and I'll reschedule it for later in the week. I'm not even dressed yet and I'm already lying in my head, right? Self-seeking motives. I hope it goes smooth. I hope it goes well. I hope I get what I want. Some form of that. And it's first thing in the morning. That's how I wake up. I wake up every day thinking about me. I'm waiting for the day that I wake up and I'm thinking about one of you. If it happens, I'll send GSO a postcard, I guess, because it's never happened. I wake up in a state of self every day. So really, when we talk about asking God to direct our thinking and divorce us from these type of thoughts, we're trying to divorce our thought life from this self-seeking plane. Now, once I do that, it tells me I'm going to be ready to do some stuff. And now I'm going to start to ask God, I'm going to picture my day, and this is what I do. I just try to relax and think about what my day is going to be. I say some set prayers, but I will tell you this, my prayers change. And when do I change my prayer? Somebody asked me that. Well, when do you change your prayer routine? The minute I can't say the prayer anymore and think about it. At a certain point, the prayer becomes just words in my head. I can think about my golf swing saying the prayer if I've been saying the same prayer for a couple of weeks. So I'll change up my prayer. Sometimes I do free form. I just pray to God about what's going on in my life. I invite him into my day, and I say a few prayers that way. Sometimes I say the third and seventh step prayer. Sometimes I have spiritual literature that I use. I'll pick something out of there, and I'll read a little bit of that. And I'll think about the words in there, and I'll incorporate that in a prayer. When I'm done with the prayer, I go into meditation. Now, there's a lot of forms of meditation, but I do the meditation described in the big book. I do occasionally do a breathing meditation. There's some other meditations I've played around with over the years, and I think those are great. But I do this meditation, which is I visualize my day. I get quiet, and I try to have a movie of what I look like being a spiritual Don through my day. And as I picture my day, there are things that I don't know what to do. And I don't worry about that. As I face my day and I go through it, there will be times that I don't know what to do. And what my book says, it gives me very simple directions. It says I pause when I'm agitated. I ask for an intuitive thought or idea. And here's where it gets really crazy. I relax and take it easy. I don't struggle. Anyone that's known me for any length of time knows relax, take it easy, don't struggle, or not in my wheelhouse naturally. That is something I've had to work on. And a lot of that feels like spiritual restraint. I don't have to do anything right now. Nothing's an emergency. I don't have to do anything right now. Nothing's an emergency. Reminding myself of that. And as I now that I get up, I have an idea of what I want to look like in my day. I ask God and I pray again and I close out with another prayer. God, give me everything I need to do that I need today to get through my day and be a good servant. And now I can go out in the day. Now that's not where it stops, because it's more important for me. How can I turn my day? How can I turn my day-to-day living into constant meditation, into constant prayer? If the idea is to have a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, how can I improve upon the time that I'm spending in the morning and the time at night? And as I said earlier, I have never gotten into a great deal of trouble on my knees next to my bed. I've never gotten into a lot of trouble sitting in my sunroom reading spiritual literature, or quietly meditating, visualizing my day as I go out. That's not where my life is lived. But the problem is, I'm in sales for a living, right? So I do a lot of presentations to people. I was talking to somebody about this. I would sooner go into a presentation naked than go into a presentation unprepared. When I go into a presentation, I am prepared. I know your contract forward and backwards. I have all the literature that goes with it. I know every objection that you might have. I've run all the scenarios through my head. I am comfortable when I walk into your home that I'm ready to talk to you and I'm ready to do business with you. I am prepared. But what about spiritual preparation? How do I do that? And what does spiritual preparation look like? You know, there's this word in the 11th step, and it's one of the most important words, I think, in the book, and the word is pause. What does the pause look like? What do I do while I pause? And I'll tell you, I do something in my life, and I do it in all areas of my life, and it works great. When I show up at work, I shut down the rig, and I don't get out of the rig, and this is why. If I don't pause before I get out of the rig, I might be like this. See, I play an important role in the company that I work at, and there's a lot of people that need a lot of things from me on a daily basis. And I will walk into work, and they are coming at me like fighter jets, right? And I will say spiritual things like, would it be okay if I got to my desk? Would that be all right? Do you mind if you see the stuff in my hands? How about you let me put my stuff down, and then we'll work on your problem, because I know you're more important than anybody else in here. How about that, Slick? Would that be okay? And I hurt feelings, and I step on toes, and I feel bad, and I have to make amends. So what I do is I shut down the rig, and I don't get out of my rig at first. I say a quick prayer. And I say, God, I'm about to go into work, and there's people in there that need things from me. You've placed me in a position of authority, and my job is to be of the maximum service to these people. Let me get out of the way. Let me take this importance I feel about my workload today, and let me set it aside, and remember, it's still going to be waiting for me, and everything gets done with your help. Now I can walk in there, and people are coming at me, and I'm like, yeah, buddy, what do you need? What's next? And I will spend the first part of my day making sure everybody else's needs are done. You know what happens when I do that? I feel good. You know what happens for the guys that work with me and under me and for me? They feel good. I never make anybody feel bad for coming to me for what I've instructed them to do. I said, if you need my help, you come to me. Don't make decisions on your own. That's what I'm here for. But if I'm going to tell people they're doing something wrong, if I'm going to correct them because they're not doing it the way I want them to do it and asking me the way I want to be asked, I'm missing the point. So what I have to do is spiritually prepare to do God's work, because naturally, that's not the state I'm in. I get to work, by the time I've left my house and driven a short 28 minutes to my office, I can be in self again. And I have to stop and take that little pause. When I go home at the end of the day, it's very important. When I get there, I shut down the rig and I do not get out of the rig. Because if I don't stop and shut down the rig and I just walk into the house, this might happen. My wife may come up on me. I mean, she may say, how you doing, honey? How was your day? And I might say, you know what? I just walked in the door. I don't even have my boots off. Would it be okay if maybe I took my boots off before the interrogation started? How about that? And she'll say, never mind, and walk away. And I'll be there confused going, what? So what I do is I shut the rig down. And I say a little prayer before I get out. And I said, God, there's a woman in that house. And you put her in my life, and she's a gift. And my job is to take care of her and make her feel safe. And God, I know she's been waiting to talk to me all day about what I don't know. But I know she's got something she wants to talk to me about, because she always does. And God, let me remember that she's a gift. She's a blessing. She's this wonderful part of my life. And let me let her feel that that's true. Let me get my selfishness out of the way. Let me put her first for just a couple of minutes. How about that, God? And God and I will have a laugh about how selfish I am, because I'm tired and I don't want to do that. But now I get right with God. Now I can walk in the house, and the first thing I do is I find my wife. Sometimes she's outside in the garden, and sometimes she's downstairs, or sometimes she's upstairs, or sometimes she's right there when I walk in, but it's my first order of business. Find my wife, put my hands on her, give her a squeeze, give her a kiss. Baby, it's good to be home. How was your day? Tell me what's going on. And she'll tell me what's going on. and we'll have a conversation. She'll get it all out, and we'll talk about it. And this big sacrifice on my part that I do in the front end of business when I get home takes maybe 5 to 10 minutes, maybe. And what it does, this is an action that God allows me to take to show my wife she is important to me. Because what the problem is, you know, with my heart and with my words, you know, I tell you how much I love you, but my actions tell you that you really don't mean that much to me. Because in a selfish, self-centered state, I don't think of you first. And I don't want to be that guy. I want to be you first. I know I'm going to be taken care of. That's part of a spiritual way of life, is the faith that you're going to be taken care of. When I go to Alcoholics Anonymous at night, I got the world hanging all over me. I've had a busy day. I've been out there slaying dragons in the real world, okay, where men got to make a living or the bills don't get paid, don't you know? I got things on my plate for the next day. I'm thinking about those. I'm thinking about the problems I had today and how I'm going to solve those. I'm thinking about whatever situation's going on at work. I'm thinking about the things I got to get done when I get out of that meeting, being spiritual. I got stuff to do when I get home. I got a busy, full life. Let me tell you about it. And I'm not ready to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I shut down the rig and I just walk in, I'm going to blow right by the newcomer. I'm going to blow right by everybody. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee. I'm going to go find my friends, and we're going to talk about our big deals and how tough it is at work and how we're slaying dragons and what we're doing that weekend and what you're watching on TV. And I'll bring a lot of crap into Alcoholics Anonymous that has no business in Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I do is I shut down the rig and I say a quick prayer, and I say, God, I'm at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Give me eyes to see and a heart to feel. Let me remember what it was like when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, it's just another Monday night, another Wednesday night, another Friday night, another Sunday morning, all the places I go to meetings. But let me remember, there's men in here, this might be their last night in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me do for them what you did for me. Let me see them. Let me acknowledge them. Let me welcome them to Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me remember what my spiritual purpose is, what my primary purpose is. Remove the selfishness from me. Now I can walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not looking for my friends. I'm not looking for a cup of coffee. I'm not looking for all the stuff that has to do with me. I'm not dragging the stuff from the outside world in with me. I'm looking at the room, and I'm scanning the room, and I'm looking for new guys. I'm looking for the guy I don't know. I'm looking for the guy who I met the night before who's new. I'm putting my hand out. I'm welcoming the Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm introducing them to my friends. I'm saying, you know where the coffee is. Let me get you a cup of coffee. Let me get you a couple of cookies. Let me introduce you to my friends. Why don't you come sit with us? The stuff we're supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Where I let Alcoholics Anonymous be the spiritual apparatus that can absorb another suffering drunk and play my role in it. But without spiritual preparation, all of these things aren't possible. I'm telling you, I'm the guy that misses my life. I'm the guy that misses my marriage. I'm the guy that misses the guys I work with. I'm the guy that misses the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm in my head. When I'm on my head and I'm playing God, everything's a movie and I'm the star and you're all just bit players and people aren't real to me. I have to have spiritual preparation. And this prayer meditation we talk about in the 11th step and in the morning and in the evening, those are the bookends of spirituality. We take the principles contained in step 11 and we start incorporating in our day-to-day living, our hour-to-hour living. And what we do when we pause and we get ready for what we're going into, we do that in every situation in our life. And we start to learn how to do it before we go in the supermarket, before we go into business situations, before we pick up our kids at daycare, before we start bringing these things in, this pause, this spiritual pause. And what is this pause for? We pause when we're agitated. We pause when we're not agitated. We pause and we spiritually prepare with the tools. And we think about, what is my job in this situation I'm about to walk into? And we ask God to give us the strength so His will can be done in whatever area it is. And I'm telling you, if you haven't done that, it's not hard. Takes about a minute at most. Shut down the rig, don't get out. Say a quick prayer, think about what you're going into. Ask God what His will is for you in that situation. You'll start walking in a different, lighter person. Sheldon?